Welcome to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, you know what we're going to talk about? Fry, 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 fry.
Oh, gosh. Yes.
Do you love fried stuff?
I absolutely love fried food. I always have, always will. And so does everybody else. They don't like fried food, or, oh, no, I don't want any of that fried food. Can I have, you know, some fried food?
It's the guilt.
It's like I can't sell a broth soup to save my life.
Should I have potato chips? Guilt. Should I have fried chicken?
How about homemade potato chips? No. Mm. Well, you can certainly buy amazing potato chips.
Well, your family's
it's pretty fun to make your own potato chip country. That's right. York, Pennsylvania. I mean, when we went to market, when we would come up from North Carolina when I was little to visit my grandma, my grandpa, and we always went to market in York. And, you know, all these potato chips and all these great pretzels and Fasnacht and Taylor pork roll and Lebanon bologna and all kinds of, you know, my grandmother would make, well, not at market, of course, but my grandmother would make pot pie, all these wonderful things. Yes. So potato chips are all American, wonderful thing.
I don't know how we can get people over the guilt of frying.
Just don't think about it. Just enjoy it.
Sometimes I think it's a terminology
thing. It has to be
done well. Because there's a certain, it does have to be done well, one.
And it has to be done fresh. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be.
And the other part
of the equation is great oil. Great fresh oil. Excellent freshly breaded product. And breaded correctly and not over-breaded.
And breaded with something nice.
Yeah, and high quality. I mean, it's all about quality.
We'll get into the details of that. Mm-hmm. We'll do some of the typicals. We'll do some of the maybe not typicals. And then we'll spend a little bit of time on wine with fried stuff, which is honestly pretty darn fun to drink.
It is. Absolutely.
And then we'll have a chef challenge where Cindy's going to suffer.
Oh, jeez. Well, and also, I mean, like, I want to ask you about Spanish fried food because you know a lot about it. And I think that's the fun thing is that everybody's culture has their own particular fried food. And does something in particular come to your mind when I ask you, when I say, you know, what in Spanish cooking?
Fish, mm-hmm. The whiting, the little. Mm-hmm. Okay, I remember having breakfast in Barcelona, and it was with Jorge Ordóñez, the wine importer.
How fun!
Which
that's
means
exciting.
That you're drinking wine at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Oh God, that's not exciting.
Well, it was exciting. It was pretty relaxed.
Oh my gosh,
it was a pretty relaxed
group.
That's
a long day if you start at 7 a.m. But
Jorge is a
professional. You already said who you were with, so yes. Anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So and very talented wine importer.
Oh, for sure.
And a very serious eater.
One of my favorite people to feed in the world, for sure.
So, but we went and we ate 3 baskets each, probably, of fried fish, little tiny whiting, smaller than your finger.
How fun!
Super crispy, and that was that a piece of cheese, some wine, a little Rioja.
Wow!
At 7 o'clock in the morning.
Purple teeth already.
Yeah, Jorge being Jorge, we got a beer when we left.
Oh, God. Wow.
Just to kind of refresh.
Mm-hmm. Fun times.
Because you need refreshment.
Fun times in Spain.
So, but that's the first thing that comes to mind. And there's so many things. Croquetas. That's one of the great things in the world to eat.
Say how you make them. You know, there's so many different things you can make croquetas with. But what's the process?
Essentially, it's a combination of mashed potatoes, as rich as you want them to be.
Yum.
The richer, the better. Some bechamel, not a whole lot, probably 20% to 80% of the mashed potatoes.
Okay.
And then you dip them, like most fried things, in buttermilk. It could be in a little bit of white wine. It can be in a lot of different things.
Okay.
A little bit of like water, vinegar solution, whatever. Just make them wet. So that then you can roll them in a little bit of very fine breadcrumb.
Mm-hmm. And any particular type of bread for the crumb or just whatever?
Panko is great to use.
Okay.
Just because it's light. You know, you'll hear them called Japanese breadcrumb, but panko's
brand name.
What you always see.
Yeah.
But that gives you a nice result.
We should probably talk about bechamel. So bechamel being one of the mother sauces.
Yeah, and sort of like the original sauce, what the Englishman would call it a white sauce.
Right, exactly. So it's just milk brought up. You can do a slice of onion, brown it on in a hot pan, dry pan, so that it gets caramelized very quickly. Add onion, a little bit of a pinch of nutmeg, excuse me, a pinch of cayenne, a little bit of salt, black pepper, and it's milk brought up to a boil, thickened with a light blonde roux, which is butter and flour used as a thickening agent. And you do not want too much. Do you want it to be thick or not?
Not particularly.
Right. So no. You're just adding that to the potato puree.
You get it thick, so it's like really creamy.
All right.
You're not making it tight.
Yeah. Okay. So bechamel, and then you want to strain it once it's done.
That's part of why it's like 80-20.
Yes. Okay. Got it.
So you mix those together, and then as soon as they're mixed, mm-hmm. you know, dip them, roll them, mm-hmm. and then you fry them. And whether it's
deep fry them.
You know, I'm a big believer in peanut oil, like you are.
Yes.
For deep frying them. You can do them in a pan. You just have to keep them rolling. Otherwise, they don't brown evenly. They don't cook evenly.
I would suggest it immersed.
That's
not the easiest thing to do in
a
pan.
Well, the thing about deep fat frying is you get that giant quantity of oil all at that temperature. Mm-hmm. It is hard to have a pan big enough with enough fat in it to have that kind of temperature. So you get that speedy transfer. You know, that speedy transfer, that's part of why
it's one of the reasons
so wonderful.
It can be the best in a restaurant.
One of the...
Because we have professional fryers.
Sort of a giant tangent, but I think important because it might take the guilt away. My roommate in college was a fellow from Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Lovely guy. His sister-in-law was a very, very good cook. They were in Baltimore for a little bit of a time. We went to dinner at their house, and she talked about dried beans, dried garlic... dried snake and dried. I'm like, huh, dried like jerky. I mean, I'm 20 years old. Drying is frying.
Oh.
And think about it. You're removing the moisture. It's cooking from its own moisture on the inside. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, their cooking's about, you know, 4,000 years more or less, probably older than ours. Hmm. They probably have this more accurately and on a basic level figured out what to call it. So I call it, you know, personally, I like to call it dried food instead of fried food.
Oh, jeez. So that's
that way
how
I feel
we
no
get
guilt.
People yeah. to not feel guilty? Okay,
yeah,
dried
maybe.
Food.
I don't think it's going to work.
I don't think that's going to work either. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I thought all that right. was sort of an interesting thing. Because when you fry something, it works. You steam it from the inside out.
Yeah.
And the faster and more completely that happens, the crispier the outside, the more tender the inside.
Right.
So a croqueta, what you're after is... the like melting mashed potato center. Oh, by the way, and I totally neglected, you can add, if you like, cheese. Manchego cheese is a big favorite and very easy to get. Mm-hmm. You can add stronger things. I mean, honestly, you can add an English cheddar to it. You want something kind of with good flavor and good fat to it.
Yeah.
And you want to, you know, grate it super fine or even microplane it into your...
Okay.
Into your
no pieces,
batch.
Secret surprise on the center.
And it makes a big difference if even 10% of it's made of other cheese.
Okay. Yeah.
So I totally neglect to say. And they need nothing. No sauce.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Nothing. A little sprinkle of parsley if you're excited.
All right. Good.
So I know you love croquetas.
I do. I think they're great.
I love those little fish.
Yeah.
Whiting is what they are.
Well, I'll never forget that time we were in Italy and we had fried fish with rice and fresh lemon when we were on Lake Como.
Well, that's a pan-fried perch.
Oh, that was so good. I mean, simple, obviously. Literally, just very simple rice right out of the lake, fried fish and fresh lemon. And it was just, I mean, I'll never forget sitting there because, one, you're sitting in this absolutely gorgeous place. We were in Bellagio on Lake Como in northern Italy.
This is not the Bellagio in Las Vegas.
No, in northern Italy. And so you're in this beautiful place, and I remember the power went out while we were sitting in the restaurant there, and nobody cared. No one cared.
Well,
everybody was just sitting there eating, drinking their wine.
They all
having
had wine.
Fun,
that's the
talking.
This is how wine makes your life better. It gives you patience.
Well, it was just nice that there was no, you know, oh my goodness, the power went out. It was like nobody cared.
What can you do about it?
That was the feeling, and it was great. It was really fun. I'll never forget that.
It's like if the fire alarm goes off, what are you going to do? I'm probably going to walk away from the fire alarm.
Yeah.
When it's over, I'm going to finish dinner. In Spain, those are my strongest memories.
What about Italy?
In Italy, my favorite thing I've ever had fried were little tiny baby octopus.
Oh, yes.
That really, really tiny fried whole. There was a little restaurant in the town of Mondello, which is near Palermo. Mondello is a little beach town. And it was the fading part of the season. It was probably the first week of October. Mm. And there's a restaurant that at that time was called Happy, which I think they thought was cool because it was a positive English word. And it was cool to have an English word. And it was basically like a shrimp shack, but it was painted white, you know. And it was, so there it is across the docks. We're walking past to go to this very famous restaurant. And we see this restaurant. The guy pulls up to the dock. And I'm like, let's go see what he's got in the boat. Because it's obviously a little fishing boat.
That's so amazing.
And so it's the brother, you know, just beginning to learn to speak Italian. It's the brother of the guy who has the restaurant. So he's bringing fish and all kinds of stuff to his brother. He's bringing clams, beautiful, beautiful clams. And they were great.
Gosh.
And they were simple steamed with garlic.
I'm completely getting hungry right now. Yeah. Oh, boy. Yes.
And that was
what
great.
What a delight. Yeah.
But he fried and basically, you know, like you would if you're a kid and you used to get like a fried shrimp basket,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's and wish you could get a sip of your father's beer. If you're that kid, it was really that basket from God.
Right.
Because they're whole fried, tiny, tiny octopus. I mean, like bigger, like as big as the joint of your thumb.
Gosh.
Okay.
Amazing.
And maybe 100 of them all set on one plate with a whole lot of fried tarragon parsley.
Okay.
And the lemons and the really sweet lemons that you get
yes.
from south of Naples.
Lovely.
The ones that grow on that hill, they're huge.
Lovely. Wow.
You know, a couple of halves of those to squeeze on and you're done. And I asked him what they fry in. He said, oil. So I never did get the secret of that. But that is my very favorite fried thing I've ever eaten in Italy.
Baby octopus. Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I cannot imagine what it would cost to have it in the U.S. I know it was at least €4.
Gosh.
Our entire meal. We had a seafood feast.
Wow.
And this is 2003. We had a seafood feast. I think we had 10 plates like this. And I think, usually pretty good remembering numbers, I think it was like €58. That included a bottle of wine, too. I think it was €58. But these guys, they weren't doing nothing else. His brother caught the stuff, and he was cooking. And then would come out and talk with us and drink wine and then go back to cooking.
That's great.
His brother went home for dinner.
What a great culture. I love it.
Yeah. It was. I had no idea at the time how special it was until I was going to sleep that night.
Yeah, I bet. Huh.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right. What about any German fried food?
Maybe Wiener Schnitzel.
That's the only thing that comes to my mind.
That's the immediate thing that comes to mind. That can be spectacular.
I love Wiener Schnitzel.
We should get into how to execute that, because that's something that is not impossible to do
mm-hmm.
for a cook at home and is very good to do in a pan. You don't have to have a tabletop
exactly.
or a deep fat fryer.
And that's nice.
To do a good job.
Yeah.
Like you can even do a bunch of the prep in advance and finish it in the pan and finish it in the oven and plate whatever else you're going to have with it.
Yeah.
Which is, that makes it a pretty good home dish, I think.
I love Wiener Schnitzel.
So what do you think is important in producing Wiener Schnitzel?
Quality of the veal. You know, it's you have to figure out which piece you're going to use. And I would probably say the top round, but it's tempting to just go ahead and do little tiny ones and do veal tenderloin. I think that would be super cute and ungodly expensive.
It would be the most expensive Wiener Schnitzel ever.
But it would just be
so I can't believe you came up with the most expensive Wiener Schnitzel.
Of course I did.
Yeah.
It would be so good. It would be mind-blowingly good, but you can use veal top round.
You can't put truffles on it either.
And with the veal top round, you're going to have to use a meat mallet to, you know, just pound it out a little bit and tenderize it a touch, but you want to slice it long. You know, you want a big piece. You know, I mean, that is a traditional portion. It's a pretty big piece, but it needs to be thin.
You pound it
to thinness.
You cut it a little thick, yeah, and you pound it to thinness.
I don't know if that's proper English.
It ends up being the size of a plate, pretty much.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
It's like putting an appetizer plate on top of an entree plate.
I might have to put that on the menu. That would be fun.
That can be pretty great.
Then fresh lemon
and capers. There's an Italian version of this dish.
Okay, good. What is it?
Milanese.
Oh, of course. Well,
Milanese. So a lot of times you'll see a veal chop done this way.
Right.
So it's cooked on the bone. Anyway, you're going through the methodology on it.
I would just say egg wash, you know, flour, traditional flour, egg wash, and then very fine breadcrumb.
So dust it in flour after seasoning it.
Yeah, salt, pepper, lightly dust and flour, shake it out.
Which means shake the flour off right. the piece of veal.
And then it will allow the egg wash, which is egg and whole egg and a little bit of water whisked together. That will allow the egg wash to stick to the veal and
so,
the
so
pound
of
veal.
So you dip the veal in the egg wash.
And then into the breadcrumb.
And then you pull it out, let the egg drip off of it.
Right, and go into the breadcrumb.
And then go into the breadcrumb.
And one of the things
about breading.
Turn it over
so you get it nice and evenly coated.
Okay. And one of the things about breading is that your breading mixture, particularly the breadcrumbs, will get yucky. So you're going to have to throw some of them away and start over again.
If you're doing four or something, yeah. you'll need a bunch of breadcrumb.
Right. And that's one of the things about, for example, we do fried oysters. And that's one of the first things if I have someone I'm teaching, which is rare because my guys have stayed so long. But if I'm teaching somebody how to do it, you know, it's always, hey, after like three or four orders, you're getting fresh flour, period. End of story. I mean, it just has to be pristine. So that is something to consider.
You don't get the same result otherwise.
When it costs nothing. I mean, you know, breadcrumbs cost very little money. So it's not like you're throwing away something that's really expensive. The egg costs little, the flour costs little, and the breadcrumb costs little. So the expensive thing is the meat.
The funny thing is in German-speaking world and versus the Italian-speaking world, I mean, the product is the same in the end. What you want is this, like, super tender, crispy veal on your plate. What you do with it then is where things are different. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, the Milanese you'll see like an arugula and tomato salad with a little bit of onion and a very, very simple dressing, and that's light on top. With the Wiener Schnitzel that you see in a lot of parts of the German-speaking world, it's always all kinds of pickles. You know,
that's
and
nice.
Some
I like that.
Sometimes a mayonnaise-y something, but always all kinds of lots of pickles.
For some reason, I thought they served it with potatoes. I don't know why I had that in my mind. Well, that seems like a good idea.
As a side dish, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I do like the pickles with it.
And on that
pickle
same
thin slices of carrots, it's pretty awesome.
And that same track, we can go right to chicken fried steak. But we'll talk about that when we come back.
Yeah, well, chicken fried steak and more about frying on Formula Wolf on Food & Wine. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
So our producer, Luke, immediately said, a deep dive into fried food, which is terrifying.
Because that
but,
would.
But he's a young man and very adventurous, I'm sure, so maybe he'll do that. I'm not going to do that in my 50s. Thank you very much. Anyway, we should finish technique on the Wiener Schnitzel and then get into that chicken fried steak.
Right, and when you talked about that you can pan fry it, and that really is how you should cook it. You could drop it in a deep fat fryer, but there's no reason for it. You can easily, because it's a thin piece of meat, it's going to, because you have pounded it, and it's not going to take that long to cook. It's probably, you know, 3, maybe 4 minutes on each side, maybe.
Well, you don't want to cook it hard.
Right, right. And you want it to be golden brown. You know, this is not right. So it's pretty quick. So you can do it in a pan.
I think a lot of times people think golden brown means it's any color, you know, like a light caramel color or something. It's always a little bit deeper than that. It's a funny thing. And you want your pan pretty high, and you want to have maybe a little more generous fat than you would have for a sauté of something.
Oh, definitely.
That's the thing.
You're not immersing it in fat, but yeah,
and it should be a very heavy pan, like a cast iron skillet would work very nicely.
Oh, absolutely, perfect.
You know, a great big copper sauté pan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you want something that doesn't have sort of slip, like a sauté pan, like an omelet pan that has 45-degree sides. You don't want.
No, you want a straight side.
Yeah, straight side, and you want to have a little more fat than covers the bottom for sure.
Right, and just be careful because anytime you have excess fat in your pan, one of the worst burns you can get is a fat burn. The only thing I can think of that's really worse is caramelized sugar, and that just sticks to you, and that's a problem with that. But you do not want to splatter fat on you. It's ugly.
If you took a deep dive into fried food, you would get a
sure
fat burn.
Luke does not do that. Yes. All right. So, with Wiener Schnitzel, and then if we talk about chicken fried steak, which is so much fun, and chicken fried steak is not chicken, it's beef.
Chicken fried steak is a big deal. When I went to college in Texas, I tell you what, chicken fried steak was a big deal.
Hmm. I've never been to Texas. I bet. That makes sense.
And one of the hardest things, because I had grown up eating beef more like medium rare.
Oh, yeah.
Chicken fried steak is
it's well done.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it has to be well done.
It better be fried nicely, because.
Right. What did they serve with it? Do you remember? I'm just curious what they would have served down there, like a salsa or something.
Potato salad.
Oh.
Potato salad a lot of times.
Oh, just add, you know, heavy to heavy.
Potato salad. Potato salad and a bunch of chopped up raw jalapenos.
Well, there you go. That doesn't surprise me. That's
and maybe a few beer.
Yes. Okay. Some you tequila
have to,
on the
you
side.
Have to, no, you have to. Well, you have to digest it.
Yeah. Well, so with chicken,
we are on the Spa Cuisine show here.
Yeah, we are. Well, and the funny thing, I said veal top round for the Wiener Schnitzel, and then of course I talked about veal tenderloin, which is ridiculous. But you would use beef top round to do chicken fried steak. So again, it's the same process. Only you want this to be a little thicker. With the veal schnitzel, you do want that to be a thin. But this needs to be a little. I would say it's probably twice as thick as you would do Wiener schnitzel.
And so is it like
you
a
want
finger?
A little body? Yeah, yeah. Maybe
finger
a little,
and a half.
No.
So about
maybe 3/4 of a finger. Yeah, 3/4 of a finger. A little finger like mine, and well, my forefinger.
Yeah, if your finger
anyway,
is bigger, just go
you're
with
like,
it.
Oh God. So. Just you have to tenderize that as well, because top round is not, you know, I mean, it's got to be beaten up a little bit. So when I say tenderize it, you want to use the side of a meat mallet that has the it looks like cleats, right? Not a flat. You need it to be broken up,
yeah.
Which the cleat side of a meat mallet will do that for you. It will help to tenderize the meat. And then you can pop it over on the flat side to really pound it out. But you want to hit it a couple of times with that. And you don't want to break up the meat. Not like tear it up.
Don't destroy it.
Right. You just want to gently break it up. So don't take what I'm saying too far. And you do want to season it well. So I would, right after I use the meat mallet, I would definitely go with salt and pepper on and rub it all over it on both sides. So it's well seasoned.
When I saw someone making it down there,
uh-huh.
They also rubbed it with vinegar.
Never heard of that.
They rubbed it with salt. They rubbed it with vinegar.
Well, that sounds good.
Then they breaded it and fried it.
Well, that's fun. And then you're doing the same breading. You can do it a couple of different ways. I like to put it into buttermilk. Now, you don't have to do that. You could do the same thing, flour, egg wash, breadcrumb. It could be, you know, day-old bread that you beat up in a food processor. Or you could use, I don't think I'd use panko for that. I would use old bread.
Not cornmeal?
You could use cornmeal.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you
cornmeal.
Say buttermilk, I immediately think, okay, this is a southern version.
Either way.
I want cornmeal, you know?
Mm-hmm. You can do either way.
You do pretty good crust on it.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah. So, but if it's cornmeal, it's going to have to be mixed with flour. So then you need to season that with, you know, I would definitely put black pepper and salt in, and maybe even a little bit of cayenne if you like a spicy food. And then that gets, again, you can do it in a pan. You don't have to do that in a deep fryer. That is the nice thing. I mean, if you're going to do this stuff at home, unless you have a small tabletop fryer, which have horrible recovery times. I mean, you can fry some, you know, that's what
you can't overload,
you were sort of referencing that before, but you didn't really come out and say it. You know, if you have a big fryer at your house, perfect. Then do what you want.
If you have a big fryer at your house, I hope it's out back.
Yeah, I know. Well, the problem with frying
because
your house is
going to smell like.
Oh gosh, that's the problem.
When you fried for three days.
That's why you go to a restaurant and eat fried food, because if it's in your house is going to smell. Also, all that fat is going to get into the air, and it's going to get on everything you own in that kitchen, and probably into the next room. I mean, it's a very fine coating, but it's a bit of a mess. And then you have to figure out how to get rid of used fat from a fryer. I mean, it's not the easiest, most pleasant thing. So that's why it's
normal residents to get rid of 2 gallons of fat.
Right, exactly. Well, and that's the other thing that's nice about the chicken fried steak or the Wiener Schnitzel is that you can do it in the pan or something like green tomatoes, easily done and in the South, always done at home in a cast iron pan with, you know, some kind of good oil and, you know, just, and they're so thin, you do a pretty thin slice of the tomato that it takes like a minute to fry them in a.
So frying like green tomato. Is it the same breading procedure for you?
No. First of all, I don't salt them, because if you salt the tomato, it leaches out the natural water content, obviously, and moisture, and you don't want that because your breading will become soggy. So unless you're just doing it like you're literally breading it and there it goes into the pan. But if you want to do, let's say you have family coming over and you want to do 26 slices of green tomato, put it on a sheet pan. Do not put any salt on. Just cornmeal mixed with a little cayenne pepper. No flour. Just cornmeal. cornmeal, cayenne pepper. You can put black pepper on if you want. You can put anything you want on there, but that's what I do. And then, so a green tomato is an unripe red tomato. It is not like a tomatilla or
it's inherently a lot crunchier.
Right. And that is it. You know, you want them and you want them to be a little bit firm, but if they're too firm, that they just won't break up when they're frying. So you also don't want them to be so underripe that they're hard. That's not appealing. But a good solid green tomato.
Man, that's a great vehicle for runny egg.
Oh, my God, I love green tomatoes. Oh, there's so many things you can do with a green tomato. One of my favorites that we're doing right now is we make a relish from Colombia that is called ají, and it has no fat in it. It is a real sort of salsa. I guess it's really not a relish. It's really a salsa. And it has everything is very finely chopped. And just my friend from Colombia, this is how he makes it. Finely chopped jalapeno, cilantro, shallots, a little bit of lime juice. That's the only moisture, salt and pepper. And then you can either use green tomato or red tomato, either one. But it's a lot of jalapeno, a lot of cilantro, and if I didn't say green onions, a lot of very finely chopped green onion. And it's just so fresh with the lime and the salt. It's just so fresh. It's so perfect for fatty fried food, which fried food really shouldn't be that fatty, but you know what I mean. It does have fat in it.
Sounds like something I'd like with a cornmeal fried softshell crab.
Oh, for sure. Actually, we ate some soft shells last night and put ají on there and a little lemon cayenne mayonnaise, too. I mean, you know, mayonnaise is perfect for fried food. That's just all there is to it. And, you know,
it gives you something to dip in.
Yeah. And some people love cocktail sauce. So that is something that you can make yourself. And I remember when
I can't do soft shell crab with cocktail sauce.
I don't. Can't. I'm not a cocktail sauce person, but a lot of people are. So when we first opened Savannah, and when we first moved here, I used to make bourbon spiked cocktail sauce, and people really loved it. And it had a little bit of do you remember what bourbon I used?
Knob Creek.
So I had Knob Creek in it, ketchup, and then we ground our own fresh horseradish, and a little bit of lemon juice and a little bit of Tabasco. That was it, and it was really
the most relaxing cocktail sauce ever.
Really good, relaxing. But yeah, fried food likes mayonnaise, so. You know, there are all kinds of different mayonnaises you can put with green tomatoes and fresh basil and with soft shell crabs. I would say that again, this is the way that I make them. When we get an order, we put the clean soft shell crab into buttermilk again. And there's nothing in the buttermilk. It just goes immersed into buttermilk. And
the trick with soft shell crabs is you have to prepare the crab, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. So you take the apron off. Off the back, you take the lungs off underneath the shell, and you have to cut the front of it off. And then you have to, once you cut, I'm
She's
not going
to
say
you
it.
Cut
I'm
the
not
going to
say
off.
It. Ah, Tony said
cut
it.
The face
it's
off.
So gross. And they have to be alive. Do not eat them if they're not alive. It's just like lobster or anything like that that you can buy alive. It better be alive when you're working with it. And, you know, obviously.
I'm sure people can see a video of how to clean a soft shell.
Right.
Crab.
And just remember that when you do cut, as you said, I hate saying this, the face off, go into where the pocket of the, I don't know how to say this, you go in where the eyes were, because there is a pocket, I guess it's, I don't know if it's their brain or what, but
there you go.
Whatever it is, that needs to be popped, because otherwise it's going to pop on you when you're frying. Soft shells can be very dangerous. We call it the safety dance at the restaurant.
Oftentimes
the cooks are like arms in front of their face and up in the air, because that sounds dramatic, but I mean, they splatter all over the place. Yeah. So once it's gone into the buttermilk, then you go into, we use the same breading procedure we use for our fried oysters, which is 50% all-purpose flour, about 50% cornmeal, and that has salt and cayenne pepper. So you go right from the buttermilk, which of course you let it drip off, into that and lightly coat it. Don't, you know, the whole thing with fried food is, as I said, is freshness of the product, the main product, whatever it is, squash blossom, little tiny octopuses, a piece of chicken, you know, soft shell crab, shrimp, whatever it is. It's got to be great. It's got to be fresh. And then lightly bread it. That is the biggest thing. And then fried in peanut oil. And that, you know, it only takes about, for a hotel, soft shell hotels, it takes about 2 minutes to fry. And immersed in fat. Now, if you're doing it on the stove and you're doing it in, say, a cast iron pan and it's not immersed in fat, I'd say maybe 4 to 5 minutes.
So if you don't have peanut oil, you don't want to use peanut oil.
You can use canola oil. You could use corn oil. I mean, and especially if you're allergic, which so many people are allergic to peanuts. I certainly understand that. So, yeah, I mean, but you just want a high...
you need an oil with a very high flash point.
Flash point, right.
And you don't want...
You don't want the oil to burn while you're cooking.
Well, and peanut oil also makes sure you get... You don't want the stuff that has what looks like chunks of peanuts in it or that smells a lot like peanuts. They do exist.
Really?
You can get them in some specialty grocery stores.
I didn't know that. Okay, no.
If people think that you're going to make the best fried food ever, you're going to make something that smells a lot like... When it cools down, it's going to smell like that peanut butter Cap'n Crunch.
Regular peanut oil. But no, you don't have to use peanut oil. You can use anything with a high flash point. But it has good flavor, so that's why we like it.
Should you fry an extra virgin olive oil?
No.
No.
Waste of excellent product.
No. That's one of us will come to your house and tell you no. That's besides being a waste of excellent product, it has a lot of flavor and not that high of a flash point, but it has a lot of flavor. So if you want it to be totally dominant, you know, if you cook a piece of mild fish in extra virgin olive oil, it's going to taste a lot more like the olives
yes.
than it is like the fish.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, we were talking about mayonnaise. Traditionally, aioli is made with olive oil. And there is a reason why aioli is only used with certain things, because whatever it's used with has to have a lot of flavor. Because, you know, when I make corn oil and the French make corn mayonnaise.
It's strong oil and it's garlic and, like, you know, that's...
Right. And when the French make mayonnaise, they use something neutral, like corn oil. And that there's a huge difference in the way that mayonnaise tastes versus the Italian. And it obviously, it goes with the different cultures' foods. That's why they're so different. And in the south of France, you're going to have probably mayonnaise made with olive oil. There are a lot of olive trees in the south of France, just like in Italy. So,
well, there's also a lot. There are milder oils and there are stronger oils, but extra virgin olive oil has a lot of flavor and not that high of a flash point. That's why you don't want to fry in it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So what are your favorite fried vegetables? What
do you think? Squash blossoms, for sure.
How about olives?
I do love those.
How about stuffed, see?
Oh, yeah, I love them.
Squash flowers, I love. Zucchini flowers, whatever you want to call them, scoop zucchini blossoms.
Yeah, but fried olives are amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like big green olives with some kind of stuffing in them. That can be awesome.
I love zucchini, yellow squash, asparagus.
Asparagus and green onions fried and that sort of like so together. Good. So you have these long spears that dip in some kind of a sauce.
Mm. And the cool thing about squash blossoms is you can stuff them. So you can either, you know, just fry the blossom and enjoy the blossom. You can also, there's a chef in the southern part of France, that southern Rhone Valley, who cuts his open and does just a whole, you know, this flat piece. I love that because they cook perfectly and they're really crunchy. And then, of course, you know, he puts all kinds of great things with it. But stuffing squash blossoms with goat cheese or basil and goat cheese or ricotta and Reggiano or any of those. Oh, my goodness. That is such a treat.
So when we come back on Formidable Fun Food and Wine, we'll talk about the good stuff. We'll talk about potato chips. We'll talk about French fries. Right?
Yeah.
That's really fried main course right there.
Good stuff.
And we'll talk about what to drink with it.
Okay.
And then, of course, you're going to have to suffer through a chef challenge.
Okay. I look forward to it.
All of that and more on Former Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Former Wolf on Food and Wine. This is Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And so, you love potato chips, right?
Of course. I mean, I don't really eat them that often, but yes, who doesn't love potato chips?
I eat them as often as I possibly can, okay?
It's funny.
Let's be realistic. I don't always feel like it's a good idea to eat a whole lot of them, but it's really, really hard to leave them alone. What kind of potatoes do you think make the best chips?
Mm. I don't know.
Because I think that to make your own chips, honestly, I mean, if you want to make really good burgers and fresh chips, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make a little pickle relish for yourself.
Why not?
Or that's, you know, I think that's kind of that's a fun thing. Or
Idaho's, and you want something with, you know, that does act right in the fryer.
What acts right?
Idaho potatoes. And then we've fried fingerling potatoes, and they're really pretty. I love the shape of a fried fingerling potato. But we've just gotten to the point where we actually just cut down our Idaho's. for the dish that it's salmon tartare. We use the Idaho on there now instead of buying the fingerlings just for that dish. And they work out really well. They just fry beautifully. And we also do a truffle potato chip. And what we use is...
Those are super addictive.
Oh, my gosh. It's a farina. It's a white truffle farina that we put on there. And we also microplane aged Reggiano on there right before we serve them. They get salt and pepper. And then we serve them with creme fraiche mixed with the white truffle farina. And oh, my
goodness. To dip it in.
Yeah. They are so good. And, I mean, I've had people say, oh, my gosh, you should package these. And that you can do that at home. I mean, easily. Microplane one of your favorite cheeses on there after they're cooled down. You don't want that to melt on there. So wait until they're done frying. But, yeah, that's fun. One of the things is don't overload the fryer. Again, your frying situation, don't overload it. And that's the truth with anything you're frying.
And that requires a deep fryer.
It does require a deep fryer, yes.
The Idahos you're talking about are often identified as frying potatoes as opposed to baking potatoes. So make sure that you get the right ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yukon Golds work for that?
They do.
Just not quite as...
Not as good.
Idaho's you don't get that super crispy
result.
That's
the only reason I buy Idaho potatoes at the restaurant is for our potato chips. And we use them for absolutely nothing. I mean, it's just no reason. We just don't need them for anything else.
This is one thing where if you try to pan fry it, they stick together.
Yeah, you can't. It needs to be immersed.
Or you can fry
four at
a time.
They need to be floating around in there, and you need to move them around. They need to be free. You know, that's the only way.
Shaking the basket whole time.
We actually take the basket out and literally let them move absolutely freely through.
And then you just go fishing?
Yes. And we use a spider. It's called a spider. And that's how we get them out. And it works much better. And you do want to fry at a lower temperature. So you're at 325 instead of... Typically, we fry, say, cornmeal fried oysters at 350, chicken at 3... Actually, everything else at 350. But potato chips, we do at 325 or even maybe 320 degrees. But that's... Yeah, you don't want the potatoes to get too brown. You want them to be just crispy.
Good. But French fries, a little more complicated.
Yeah, you have to do those in batches.
And those you could do some in pans with a deep amount of oil, but
mm-hmm.
it'll be a little bit of a pain in the backside, yeah.
Yeah, and also when I say in batches, so you have to sort of what we call blanching the potatoes first. So you blanch them, and maybe they're down for 2 minutes at 300 degrees.
You blanch them, but this is not water.
This is oil.
This is their first passage in the oil.
Yeah. And then you lay them out on a pan so they're not on top of each other, and when you're ready to eat them, then you drop them again at 350.
And it's probably another 3 minutes, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Just depends on the size and shape of the potato.
Don't overload the basket.
Never.
And you got to shake them.
And honestly, that's a philosophy with almost everything you do cooking. You don't overload a pan at any time. So if you're sautéing shrimp or you're sautéing a couple of chicken breasts or you're trying to sear something, you definitely cannot overload a pan. And that's why you need the right size pan for the amount of product, or you have to work in batches.
Well, cooking is the transfer of heat, right?
Yes.
So your job, if you want to be a good cook, is to learn how to transfer heat well.
Yes, that's right.
So that's...
Without burning, without undercooking.
The size of the product and the size of the vessel, their relationship is the first and most important thing, honestly,
I absolutely agree.
Learning to cook well.
That's why this conversation actually has good information in it, because by immersing something in fat, you're cooking it as evenly as you possibly could, because literally it's completely immersed, or it would be the same thing as boiling something, green vegetables, in a big pot of water. That, again, has to be a huge amount of water, or much more than the amount of product you have, because the recovery, especially with a green vegetable, it has to recover almost immediately. And that way you don't lose vitamins and you don't lose color, and, you know, things are cooked correctly.
Cooks quickly, completely.
Yeah.
That's the same thing in the fat. I guess one of the things that people think is, greasy. It's going to be, you know, much more fatty than something else.
The faster you cook it, the less fat that's absorbed.
Yeah, one. And two, the breading on the outside keeps fat from penetrating. When you're frying something, it steams out, right? Which means it constantly, it's releasing from whatever that product is. It's constantly releasing.
You can see the steam coming out of the fryer when you fry things, especially potatoes, which have a high water content.
If you've got something that's loaded correctly and the right the right ratio, you're going to have, honestly, as long as you blot it well on the outside, then you're going to have probably the cleanest, most oil-free product that you possibly can.
Right, and it's cooked at the right temperature. So you're not cooking it too long. You know, it's not getting soggy, and you're cooking it correctly, basically. So you're having the right function, and you have this, you know, a sheet pan with paper towels on it, or we use hotel pans, third pans with paper towels in the bottom, and you know, it comes right out of the fryer, right onto that paper. So any fat on the outside can immediately be absorbed by that paper towel.
So to recap, soggy is one end of the spectrum, crispy is the other end of the spectrum.
Right.
The closer you are to crispy, the more successful you've been in frying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready to do a chef's challenge and talk about the transference of heat?
Sure. Yes. I'm excited. Okay.
Because I don't have to read my own handwriting.
Fava beans, maitake mushrooms, English peas. Ooh, fresh tagliatelle. Butter
ooh,
and all,
you're
ooh,
welcome.
I love it. Butter and all dairy, soft shell crabs, spice rack, golden beets, garlic, shallot, onion. That's funny. Fresno cherries, carrots, gabine.
Fresh, it sounds a little bit like chili. a sound kids make when they
golden
crash
beets.
Cars. Gabine. Yeah, but three-year-olds, well, what do you think about?
Now you're going to hear about how I do soft-shell crabs again. So you didn't give me buttermilk. You didn't give me...
All dairy.
Oh, all dairy.
What part of buttermilk is not part of all dairy? I know that you are like the dairy farmer's friend. I know you need all dairy or you can't cook.
Okay. So the soft-shells go into the buttermilk and then into the cornmeal breading procedure, which is cornmeal, all-purpose flour, salt, and cayenne pepper. And they're fried in peanut oil. And... what I absolutely want to do is make a relish with the golden beets. So I'll roast the golden beets.
Go ahead. I forgot to give you your condition, so I'll stay off of it.
Oh, what's my condition? I'm cooking in the forest.
No, it would be nice. be relaxing.
No, it would not be for me anyway. I mean,
that's why I live in the forest.
Not cooking in the forest anyway. Yes.
The range top works. The oven is out. You have no deep fat fryer. That's like
Okay. That's okay. Fine. All right. All right, so I'm roasting. Wait a minute, did you say the oven doesn't work?
No.
Oh, I have to boil the beets. All right, so I'm going to boil the beets in water with a good bit of salt and a tiny bit of sugar and a piece of lavender, a couple pieces of lavender in there. I'm going to peel the beets. Actually, yeah, I am going to peel the beets before I boil them. Actually, I'm also going to put a little bit of apple cider vinegar in there. And did I say sugar? So I'm going to boil the beets in, and I want it to actually not be a little bit of vinegar. I want it to be a good bit of vinegar. I want them to be tart and sweet at the same time.
Like
they're peeled and boiled, yeah. And then, so that's that. And the garlic, shallot, onion, just a tiny bit of all three. Finely chopped, the Fresno chilies, finely chopped. The carrots I'm going to boil just in water with salt. And I'm going to, what do I want to do shape-wise with that? I'm going to do a small dice of the carrots. And so that's all going to get mixed together. And that's going to be a relish. And that's going to go on the soft-shell crab. And then so that's that dish.
Mm. So beet relish for the soft-shell crab.
Yeah, yummy.
So tart and snappy, that's good.
Right. And then the tagliatelle, for sure, that's easy. The fava beans, the English peas, and the maitake mushrooms. So maitakes, I'm going to pull them apart gently, and if I have to cut off the ends, I will. And I will caramelize those in butter with salt and pepper. So cooked until they're a little bit crispy. The fava beans and the English peas, fava beans will be boiled and peeled, and the English peas will be boiled and peeled as well. Because I'm doing this at home and I have time, and English peas without the outer shell are really nice. So all three of those things would just get tossed with the tagliatelle, a little bit of butter, and the gabine cheese. I'll microplane the gabine cheese over the top. There you go.
Really?
Yummy. There you go.
Gabine on pasta. Do you want to tell people what a gabine is?
So gabine is a small farmhouse cheese from Great Britain that is a cow's milk piece, but it's a washed rind piece. So it just depends on how old it is. It can be buttery, gorgeous, soft on the palate, and just have good flavor all the way to, if it's got some age, it is funky, gorgeous, deep, rich, caramelly, nutty, mushroomy, gorgeous cheese. So
it's
the only way to microplane it.
British Isle cheese.
Oh my gosh, gabine is amazing.
For people that think that only French cheese can be great because it's strong, because it's so rich.
It really is amazing.
So how do you microplane it?
Well, it would have to be cold, and it would have to be younger. So if it was younger, I could maybe not microplane it, but I could grate it for sure. Yeah.
Yeah,
it is a soft cheese. Don't be misled. It's not a hard pressed piece. It is a soft washed rind piece.
It's one of those really remarkable. It's an Irish cheese, and it's really one of the great things.
Well, and also with that, I mean, I could just do the pasta with the fava beans and mushrooms and the English peas and a little olive oil and then serve a piece of gabbana afterwards. That would probably be the best way to handle it.
Yeah, nice to have a cheese course. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I have squash blossoms, okra. I love okra. Cornmeal, AP flour, all-purpose flour. Peanut oil, sparkling water, baking powder, baking soda, cake flour. You want me to fry something in tempura batter, I think. Since those are all the ingredients of tempura batter. Kosher salt, spice cabinet, herb garden. Okay. You want me to cornmeal? You want me to tempura okra?
But you have things at the bottom.
Squash? What?
You missed some ingredients at the bottom.
I have not gotten there yet.
Oh, jeez.
I'm still reading the other words. Try to calm yourself.
Well, I meant to put them all together.
I understand. Not worried about it.
Go ahead.
Fresh tomato, onion, shallot, garlic, all kinds of small farmhouse cheeses, and a whole chicken. All right. Well, first thing I need are a couple of bottles of champagne. And to get your mind right to fry something, you need champagne. It's one of the rules.
Yeah, we have to get to wine for fried food, Tony.
It's so champagne. Champagne really and sparkling wine is great for fried food.
Okay.
There's an Italian wine that's a big pet of mine for fried food called Frascati. It's one of those things that you always see. It's from Lazio. It's a wine that you often see in all the little terrazzas and the cafes in Rome.
Nice.
Which is a city where fried food is their calling card food-wise. Let's see. Well, the squash blossoms and the okra, I do want to tempura them. No, I'm not going to. I'm going to do the squash blossoms. He gave me everything to do it with. I can't not do that. And I may not use that cornmeal. I'm going to use the cake flour, the baking soda, the baking powder, the sparkling water, and a little bit of the kosher salt. And I'm going to make a tempura batter, and I'm going to fry those squash blossoms in 350-degree peanut oil in a big deep fat fryer, because in the woods I have one of those.
Did I say you were in the woods?
You did.
I did not.
From the herb garden, I'm going to get a little bit of lemon balm, and I'm going to grind that with a little bit of lemon juice and oil, and I'm going to sprinkle the flowers when they come out, and we'll have that with all that champagne. Maybe a nice blanc de blanc, like Fournier. And then, so the chicken, what I want is to slow roast the chicken, stuffed with onions and shallots. I'm sorry, stuffed with garlic and shallots, rather. Seasoned with tarragon for a pretty good long time, and a little bit of cayenne on that bird too. And can I have a piece of bacon, please?
Mm-hmm.
I want to put some bacon on the outside of that bird, get a little bit of pork fat smoke into that bird, and I'm going to serve whole pieces of that. What I want to do with the okra is use some of the fresh tomato and the onion and the garlic to make a stew.
Exactly what I would have done.
I like that gooey, stringy okra texture. That's something that I like. I grew up with okra. I want the stew for that roasted chicken. And I want the roasted chicken to come out a little bit spicy. That's kind of...
Sounds all right.
That's kind of where I'm at. So
okay.
I think that's all we have time for on The Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
If you'd like to download this program or any other program from us, you can look for podcasts on the WYPR website, The Foreman and Wolf page, and download what you like. If you'd like to email us, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf or on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf.
And from time to time, I'm the real Tony Foreman.
On Instagram.
From time to time, I'm really the real Tony Foreman when I'm not on Instagram. Anyway, thanks for listening.
And have a great Sunday.